Okay, so just to kind of recap where we left off, because I know Snow Day messed up everybody. We went through a cell that was, if you just listened to it on the podcast or the Echo, it was probably pretty crazy because the Echo didn't record the doc cam. But basically the cell resting membrane potential, what was the take home here? It depends, right? There's no set resting membrane potential. There's lots of factors that contribute to the resting membrane potential. Main things that we talked about in here were K2P channels, which are leak channels for potassium leaking out of the cell, and NaCl, NaLCN, sodium leak channel that sodium leaks into the cell. And then we talked about other factors that contribute, such as somewhere in this diagram, I think it's in there, sodium potassium pumps. Don't know where that is. Here, no, that's not even, it's not even in there. How about that? Sodium, potassium, pump. Pump sodium out, pump potassium in. Okay, which is probably the most energy demanding process. And then we talked about other things that control membrane potential, which aren't really mentioned that much in some of the textbooks, except for one chapter. And that's even, you have the calcium pump that pumps calcium out, which isn't in here, can pump calcium out. ATP, I think we have it on a different figure. And then you have even bicarb chloride exchangers, so exchangers don't require ATP. And then you have other types of exchangers, which we didn't really get into too much. It could be a sodium bicarb for chloride out. It could be multiple factors. We talked about sodium being a co-transporter with amino acids, and that pH, hydrogen ion outside a cell really doesn't impact the inside of the cell directly. It can't, just a hydrogen ion can't go across, but it affects the bicarb outside the cell, and then the bicarb's exchangers can actually impact the pH inside the cell, but also any metabolism that's inside the cell, like CO2 being produced as a byproduct, right? From TCA cycle, that CO2, depending on where the carbonic anhydrase is, it can, in many cells, all cells that have looked at, have carbonic anhydrase in there, so that can convert it to bicarb and hydrogen ion quite quickly, and then that bicarb can be pumped out. But your cells, inside your cells, you have a lot of buffers, so that can buffer quite a bit, but then you have ways to control that also by getting CO2 out of the cell, and then converting it to bicarb and hydrogen ion, say like we talked about in exercising skeletal muscle, such as in your red blood cells that are in your circulation outside. We talked about one other thing that's kind of different, that's not in any of the textbooks, and that's not in these general textbooks. That is accessory proteins that are around channels. All your channels have accessory proteins, and they control the structure of that channel, right? So that's the main take-home that we were getting out of that. Some of these accessory proteins, they've now found, now that they know which ones they are and where they're binding to, pathological problems in people that aren't expressing it right or have a mis-expression, gene expression for it, and it's not a normal protein, and that those can cause alterations in how these channels function. So that's kind of interesting. Because we don't really talk about these accessory proteins that much. But other terms you might have heard of those accessory proteins, such as heat shock proteins, right? Heat shock proteins are also accessory proteins that can help keep the conformation of these channels in place with temperature changes. And it's just not heat temperature, higher temperature, but also colder temperature. Okay, so I think we covered most of that stuff, just kind of refreshing it in case we're forgot about it all. Okay, let me make sure. And, oh, I just sent you, just to, let me cover this in 350 kind of, but just to refresh ourselves why all this is important too about channels, let me pop this up. We covered some of this in other classes. So some of you have seen this before already, but just, this is a little bit of a rehash. Lots of different things that are impacted on the cell and the axon and in the terminal. Just to think about this again, we have voltage gated channels. We're not showing the leak. We're having the leak channels here as like one channel, but it's really two different channels, right? K2P channels and the NALCM. And the pump, a calcium pump, exchangers, voltage gated channels, different types. And then you even have channels which we just mentioned a little bit last time, like the calcium activated potassium channels. So when calcium rises inside the cell, can quickly pump it out. The other thing we wanted to mention is differences on, like a neuron, for example. These channels can be localized differently in the dendritic tree, the soma, the axon, the terminal. And we still have that bet going on for you, $200, right? Okay, keep looking. Maybe you'll make it, who knows? And then basically unmyelinated axons, but there aren't really negative axons, but they might have one wrapping around it, but generally we call those unmyelinated. Okay, so this just kind of gives you another impression, in case you haven't seen this in other classes, that there's different types of these voltage-gated sodium channels, and they're given these little subscript names. We don't want to go to depth about these, but you have different types of voltage-gated sodium channels that open up at, say, different voltages. And you can see here's the myelin sheath around right here. So this is that nodal region, and they localize differently. And then you have a lot of different types of potassium channels and pumps, right? And they even have these subscripts for these different types of potassium channels here. This little F1 is kind of interesting. It's like a funny potassium channel. And then there's these other types of, here's your pump, and here's your sodium calcium exchanger. Just that you get an impression that they're not all evenly distributed across the cell, and that can change. And here's your $200 bet is, where have they ever mentioned, recorded the action potential shape in a mammalian neuromuscular junction in the nerve terminal, which we know is different because calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels are localized in the nerve terminal to actually allow calcium in for vesicles to fuse and then cause transmitter release. And we'll go through some synaptic transmission a bit later if you're not familiar with that. Okay, and then just to show you some diagrams here, and I just sent you this by email this morning, PDF and PowerPoint, but I'll put it up on the webpage, that there's on a regular action potential, there's lots of different types of voltage-gated potassium channels that open on the upstroke. And here's your calcium-activated potassium channel. And these could be open and inactivate very quickly. They could be delayed. They could open and stay open the whole time until the membrane comes back down. Some of them are just like the sodium channel. They desensitize very quickly. The idea here, the take-home on this picture, is that all cells are different. These localized types of voltage-gated potassium channels are different in different regions of, say, a neuron or a cell, so they're not all in one spot. And here we see the resting membrane potential as this K2P type of channel. Now, of course, there's going to be sodium leak as well. And then what's the driving force for, say, sodium? It's wherever the equilibrium is for sodium. So let's say it's way up here. And the equilibrium for potassium is way down here, right? So the E potassium is some negative value. So if you open up this potassium channel, you don't have much driving gradient for potassium to go out of the cell. But there's some. But the more that you depolarize, the stronger that gradient becomes for that particular channel. So that can help counteract the sodium that's going into the cell. Then others will have a different voltage sensing ability way up here somewhere. Okay, so the take home here is that there's lots of different variations of channels that give rise to the shape of the action potential, and they have lots of different types of kinetics, if you will. And this is just highlights some of that. So like this particular potassium channel opens, so they're giving a depolarization of the membrane, voltage depolarization, and then opening up the channel and seeing how that channel works. So this one opens and stays open the whole time. This one opens and inactivates, much like a voltage-gated sodium channel. This one's slow to open. It's called a delayed potassium channel. It's delayed, but as soon as it stops, you're not depolarizing that membrane anymore. It turns off. And now you see that these are open, but they take a much higher threshold, a higher voltage to open in the first place compared to these will open at a lower voltage. So It's just that you have many different types of potassium channels open. I think that gets missed in a lot of other courses that you have, and it depends on which classes you have, right? That it's a lot more complicated than we might anticipate. And this is important for clinical use too in people, right? Because they're trying to target different aspects of this mutation. So if you just look at, which is a C fiber, which is considered like a pain fiber, considered unmyelinated, but not totally unmyelinated, we see that there's different types of channels located in the sensory endings over here, along the axon, all these types of potassium channels, in the cell body, as well as in the nerve terminals where the transmitter is going to be released. So the take home here again is the distribution's all different, right, across the cell. Where are all these proteins made? Cell body, right? So that means they have to sort. If you had cell biology, and I don't know if everybody had, you might have gone into cell sorting and how that works. And so that's a whole nother aspect about making a protein and then sorting it so it goes to the right location. And then it has to stay in that location, right? But all these channels, all these proteins, are they there all the time? From birth until the end? They have a turnover rate, right? I find that still just mind-blowing, right? Don't you find that mind-blowing? Think of all those channels that are in that neuron and all the different types. The proteins are made. They have some rate that they're made. And then they have to turn over. And they get degraded. And then new ones are made. And they have to sort to the right spot and then get inserted in the membrane. I mean, that's wild. Isn't that wild? And are all of them turning over exactly at the same rate? No, probably not, right? And so how does all that happen so evenly to keep an action potential shape going and synaptic transmission working? I just find that unbelievable. It's just amazing, right? It's amazing. So it's just think of all the proteins in your body, every protein in your body. Your pumps turn over, right? Sodium potassium pump, sodium calcium exchanger, all those things turning over all the time. And the more active those cells are, they might even turn over even faster, right? So that's a lot of amino acids being made and proteins being made and degraded. Does anybody remember like how proteins are recognized for to be turned over, ubiquitization and stuff like that? We haven't really gone into it. We could. That's more cell biology aspects, but we can talk a little bit about it because they're using some cool animal models to understand some of those things, like hibernating animals that are, you know, basically slow down all their metabolism, and then now they're beginning to look at protein regulation in those animals too to see how do they regulate their rates. It's pretty interesting now that the tools are available, so can really address some of these comparative aspects a lot more. So just to get you an idea, that, you know, on this point, we don't want to just teach this as a neurobiology course, but the shapes of these action potentials, these are drugs that people use, TEA and formiminopyridine. They block different types of potassium channels, but you can see how it impacts the shape of the action potential. If you block this particular potassium channel, so here's control, here's the blocking, and that it has a wider shape because you're not bringing it back down as fast because that potassium channel is blocked. And then you take it away, wash it away, and it goes back to the normal one. This particular blocker blocks a different type of potassium channel. And you can actually see when you use this one, the action potential amplitude got bigger. So this tells you this potassium channel probably was open early on the upstroke. And since you didn't block it, since you blocked it, now more sodium can go in and it got a little bit bigger and wider because it's not coming back down so fast. So just the idea of playing around. This drug, formiminopyridine, is actually used clinically in some people, and it some people don't want to use it and others do because its window of therapeutic index is very narrow. And they have to have it in a clinical setting when they're using this drug. But it's kind of interesting. They're experimenting with this on patients, actually. Okay, so that was the main idea with those things. Not to try to memorize it all, but just to get the main points down. Okay, so that takes care of that stuff. All right. So if we looked at some of those chapters, and I know that's a lot of information, but hopefully it's an overview, right? It's not trying to memorize little details, just giving you the big picture to realize it's complex, right? Okay. On those chapters, let's just go through a few of those chapters to get the kind of the main points out of those. Hopefully you can see that. I know it's really small, but you got those PDFs as well that I sent. Maybe I can make this a little bigger. I'm not sure about that. Just to get the idea of what people have done. I think I sent you the YouTube video of T.D. Young that did the squid axon. Did I send that to you? Yeah, okay. I mean, isn't that cool that he took that axon out of the squid, rolled it out, put the cytoplasm out. He could put different solutions inside of it, reperfuse the squid axon like a balloon. I mean, that's amazing, right? They were just lucky. It was serendipity, you know, just by accident. And they didn't have the salines that they knew were going to be right. But what they did was they just used seawater, ocean water, and put those squid axons in it. So those first recordings were just done in a seawater bath because they thought, well, squid live in seawater, so maybe the seawater will work. Wow. You know, lucky that it did, right? So they really figured out a lot. But the concentration in different animals, you have to really, don't try to memorize numbers, but just to get the idea of why that seawater worked for them is because that concentration of different ions worked pretty well for them. Seawater is about, it's very high in osmolarity. Look at that, 460 millimolar of sodium. Chloride's really high. Calcium's pretty high too. And potassium's, you know, low, but not too high. But it's, we only have about 5 in us, for example. And then they think about the exoplasm. Look at that, 400. I mean, that's gigantic. That's a big difference, a big driving gradient, right? And sodium's pretty low inside of the cell. Okay, and then calcium, of course, low, but it depends like what's going on and where it is, if it's in the nerve terminal, for example. So that was just to get some idea, and the idea that they could actually use the seawater, and that was phenomenal. We went through that already, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Great tattoos. If you get tattoos, I guess you get extra credit or something. All right. I think that was it for this chapter pretty much. Oh, this figure was really cool. I don't know if you happened to look at this figure a little bit more in depth. This was some of the early work. This was done, which year was this? This is like in the 50s, I think. Well, this was written in 69, but I think these experiments were done earlier. This was helped to show how the pump works. And this was in a snail neuron, if I believe right. And snail neurons are relatively large, so you can actually put multiple electrodes into it. It's kind of big enough to see in a dissecting microscope, actually. So there's not many preps. Most of our neuron cell bodies are pretty small. So if you want to do recordings in it, it's really hard to do. One of the neurons that people like to work on in mammals are the Purkinje cells in your cerebellum. Those are those real big cells that you might have seen in pictures. They're kind of planar, has a big cell body, and then the dendritic tree is like that. It's in your cerebellum. So people like to do slices in cerebellum and study those, because they're big cells and you can get multiple electrodes in them. Why do you need multiple electrodes? Because you want to voltage clamp the membrane with a pair of electrodes and then measure maybe current that flows with your other electrode. So you got to stab lots of electrodes in the cell, and that damages the membrane, right? So what this experiment was doing was something really cool. They hold the membrane potential. So over here is voltage clamp. So they're holding the membrane potential over here. And then they inject current, they inject sodium into the cell. So if you inject sodium, so here's your sodium injection, inject sodium into the cell, they watch the membrane potential. After they finish the injection, the membrane potential hyperpolarizes. Why would it hyperpolarize after you inject sodium in it? But you would expect the sodium, the membrane to depolarize, right? But it's not depolarizing because they're voltage clamping it, all right? So they're clamping the voltage. And they inject sodium current. If they didn't clamp the voltage, of course it's going to depolarize because you're injecting sodium. So they clamp the membrane, they inject sodium into the cell, and then all of a sudden the cell will hyperpolarize, or the current, you'll see the membrane potential drop after the sodium is injected. It's kind of interesting. The point they were trying to make is the sodium potassium pump is super active. After you've injected the sodium in there, it wants to pump it out. So it hyperpolarizes by pumping sodium out so fast, 3-2. So it's pumping so much sodium out. And if you do the same thing with lithium, which can go through sodium channels, but lithium, people take lithium sometimes for psychological reasons. It can go through sodium channels, but it doesn't activate some things inside of cells as well as sodium. So what's happening here is they inject with lithium, but the sodium potassium pump doesn't work with lithium. So you're not seeing hyperpolarization afterwards, so the pump's not really working, which is part of the problems with the clinical treatments. So they do the experiment again. Wabin is a sodium potassium ATPase blocker. So they block it. It's depolarizing a little bit because that blocks, and even though they're trying to clamp the membrane. But then they inject sodium, and they don't have much effect, to show you that this hyperpolarization is hyperactivity of the pump. So if you block the pump, you can't get the sodium to get pumped out when you pump it in. So it's kind of neat. And then they did these kind of cool experiments where they used extracellular potassium. They kept it low, taking it out of the bath, right? Substituting osmolarity with something else. They inject the sodium again, but if there's no potassium outside, the sodium-potassium pump, it's getting kind of crazy, right? And then they take that away, and then all of a sudden they can get this to work. So it's showing that it needs the sodium to pump out and potassium to pump in for that pump to work. So these were some of the earlier experiments that they could actually do to help understand how important the sodium potassium pump is. Just kind of cool because we don't see these kind of pictures in many general textbooks that we talk about. But it shows you again that it depends on the preparation, and kind of like this August Kroger principle that we've talked about finding the right animal to do the right kind of experiments, and you can do these uncertain ones. Julie has a question.
Are these like specialized cells, or is this like when you inject sodium into a cell, it always hyperdepolarizes slightly?
If you don't voltage clamp it, it would probably hyperpolarize, but these are neurons, so they're probably super active with the sodium potassium pump because they're used to high activity, and then they can get their equilibrium back really quickly.
Yeah.
So I think for neurons, I don't know about all cells, but probably the neurons are just packed full of sodium potassium pumps compared to, say, maybe another cell like a liver cell or an endothelial cell or something like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes?
Is the ratio, ratio between pump in and out always the same? It just speeds up whenever it needs to? Or is it like change?
Yeah, that's really a good point. So, I don't know if I said it in this class or other classes, I can't remember from one year to the next. The sodium potassium pump, generally we think of 3 to 2, three sodiums to two potassium, so it's doing more sodium. But really that's a misconception. It depends on the cell that one's using. Some cells it's 4 to 3. Some cells it's not really 3. And so it's just a generalized figure. They average it to be 3 to 2, but not all cells are 3 to 2. Okay. And then if you depolarize the cell, it's actually more active. So this is why they use the term electrogenic. So these pumps are electrogenic. You depolarize, it can actually even work better. And then when you hyperpolarize the cell, it doesn't work as much. So that's kind of interesting too. So maybe if they did something different on these, that'd be cool. Maybe they probably did those experiments. Inject chloride into the cell and load it up with chloride and hyperpolarize it more. And then maybe do this experiment. Maybe we wouldn't see it come back up so fast. Maybe it wouldn't be pumping so quickly, because the pump is electrogenic. I don't know how well it decreases with hyperpolarization, but I know as you depolarize, it's more active. And that's just weird itself, right? That means protein conformation is different somehow, right? That's interesting. You wonder about temperature effects, right? That's kind of interesting, because you would think, I still find this, it's just mind-blowing. If anybody wants to talk about like these for a presentation, remember so side note, we want to try to get, if you find a paper that's really interesting, we should probably think about, give everybody opportunity. We have, 13 people in here, I think. Maybe do 10 minutes or 15 minutes each or something like that. Find something that's really interesting that you like on a comparative aspect, and then we could talk about it, send it out to everybody, and then you could present it, right? It'd be kind of fun. No? I know. Some people don't like public talking, but it's good to have a discussion on something that's interesting to you, right? So find something, and somewhere throughout the semester, we'll say, maybe you two you have something. Okay, this next Friday, or whenever we have class, Thursday, we'll do those two, right? Something like that. Okay, does that sound good? Not intimidating, just fun. I know people hate public speaking, but it's okay. We're all here, right? But I think it'd be cool. So we were on this pump. I don't know about the hyperpolarization, if it's more active or not, but the temperature, what's interesting is you raise temperature, metabolism goes up, right? You would think then the pump was going to be more active. But what happens with temperature and membrane potential? You raise temperature, the membrane potential generally hyperpolarizes. Which then, how is it more active if the membrane's hyperpolarized, right? I just find all of that to be quite a mystery, right? So it's kind of interesting. So would the pump not work as much because of it? But if you raise the temperature, maybe the enzymes in the cells and metabolism can work better because they're more mobile, right? And they can move around a little bit easier and you're changing that structure until the heat shock proteins start to kick in and then maybe it slows down. So it'd be interesting to look at metabolism initially and then maybe raise it up slowly, right? Maybe see the metabolism or oxygen utilization, CO2 production. Maybe it would go up and then it would start to equivalent and come back down, maybe as it can't be that active anymore. There's lots of things to do, lots of things to think about. And this is what keeps everybody, researchers, off the streets. They can keep working. Okay. But there's lots of things. Just think outside the box. There's lots of stuff out there. That's really cool. I think that did it for that chapter pretty much. If there's anything that people picked up that are interesting, I just wanted to also mention, you might see in text or if you're covering a paper or something, a lot of the explanations of how membranes, I hate that when it happens. Membranes, is they put that into physics diagrams, and just that we're all kind of familiar with this. This is capacitance across the membrane. There's a charge, right? Negative on the inside, relatively positive on the outside by definition. And so this is the charge capacitance. And then we have whatever channel it might be, like a potassium channel that's holding here. So that's the conductance through their G. So R, you could, so 1 over G is resistance. So this is the conductance of the potassium. And this is, in this example, they're showing this as a potassium pump. But really, like a sodium potassium pump is your battery. So that's your battery across the cell. And to explain things, this is the way that they use these diagrams to understand if it channel opens, the resistance decreases and conductance goes up. And, the pump is always working to reset it. So this is just an interpretation of this potassium type of channel. So to understand how potassium channels work, for example. There's lots of different diagrams that people use for understanding current flow across cells and try to understand how these cells work. So I don't want to go into that right now. I will show you something else. Okay, that's it for that chapter pretty much. And then here you go. This chapter, this was that other book. I know I'm jumping through all three books for you. But it's kind of neat because this table is kind of nice because it talks about, or at least highlights all the different types of channels, various types. Here's the sodium. Delayed rectifier, we talked about these different types of potassium channels. Here's one that fast transient. Remember we talked about the different drugs? And some of these are blocked by different types of ions. So cesium blocks these, and then voltage-gated calcium channels, chloride channels. All right, and there was something else about this chapter. It was cool. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah. This was kind of a neat statement. Calcium channels were accidentally discovered in the crab leg muscle, which have calcium-driven action potentials rather than the typical sodium-driven action potential. 1951. So after they figured out all the squid stuff and they were working on frog muscle, they started to work with other preps that they could keep alive. And then finding out that many arthropods, crayfish, crabs, arthropods, lobsters, insects, articulated legs, right? Arthropods, but crustaceans in particular. Their skeletal muscles are different than ours in the sense that if you have transmitter released and it depolarizes, some invertebrate muscle can make action potentials, boom, travels down. Some do not make action potentials because they don't really have voltage-gated sodium channels in the membrane. So they graded the more transmitter that's released, and those ion channels open up and allow sodium to go in, the receptor for that transmitter, sodium to go in, it depolarizes. The more transmitters, the more depolarization. But what they found out in the crab, they can actually have, calcium channels that will open up, they're voltage sensitive, so calcium will go in. And why do they have that in the skeletal muscle? Because in the skeletal muscle, calcium is the trigger for muscle contraction, right? In us, we don't have calcium to go through our plasma membrane and our skeletal muscle, right? We depolarize, and that's what we're going to go over. And we open up basically an internal organelle, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and dump calcium out that way. And that's how our muscles contract. Except for our heart muscles, right? Our heart muscles, calcium comes across the plasma membrane. So our heart muscles, in many crustaceans, skeletal muscles kind of function the same way. So people are using some of the crustacean skeletal muscles to try to understand more about how our heart works, mammalian hearts work. That's kind of neat to think about. And remember the crab muscles where they described first the sodium potassium pump too. So pretty cool. So a lot of things from comparative biology that we wouldn't really know much about us if we didn't have all those earlier experiments. All right, so that was just that point. And that was about it for this. We talked about those things already. And, oh yeah, we will get into synaptic transmission later on. Okay, so we will talk about that later. So, one thing, other things about channels. So, channels can be open all the time, constituently active, supposedly like our K2P channels and our sodium channels, right? But that's not necessarily true either, because they can be modulated by what? They can be modulated by stretch of the membrane. That can actually open up these channels. We know that stretch can actually open up K2P channels more so. Not more current, but actually activate new K2P channels. So that's kind of interesting. Some K2P channels are pH sensitive. So that's interesting that they sense the pH, and then if you have a low hydrogen ion, they will actually close. So that means they're not always constitutively active, right? So if the pH rises, even on the outside the cell, extracellular solution, they will close. And what happens? The cell depolarizes, because K2P is for potassium channels. So that means more sodium will be going in than potassium leaving. So the cell depolarizes. And I think that's how some of the cells like sense for our sensing our body, our pH, actually function. It's those K2P channels that are pH sensitive in our carotid bodies, right? Not carotid sinuses, carotid bodies. But also in the base of our fourth ventricle in our brain, where the cerebral spinal fluid goes over, those neurons there control our respiration. It's called the nucleus tractus solitarius, if you've taken that neuroanatomy course that they offer here. And those sense a pH in your cerebral spinal fluid. And they can control our breathing rate. So K2P channels, even though the textbooks will say they're constitutively active, and same with the sodium channels, not necessarily so. So again, what did we just learn? It depends, right? Everything depends. Nothing's black and white. And that's the difference of upper level courses. We begin to realize we don't know anything about anything, really. It's just amazing. And then there's channels which open to a voltage, right? How do they open a voltage? Because those are amino acids that line that make up the protein, right? And the amino acids have a charge. So if there's negative charge, or and one side compared to the other side, let's say there's some glycoproteins that are sticking inside the membrane. So here's your cell, and the bottom is inside the cell, and you have some positive charges here. What's going to happen if we inject sodium into the cell, or if sodium's coming in through an action potential coming down? It's those positive charges are going to sense that positive sodium, and they're not going to like that, so they're going to change their conformation, right? They want to get away from that sodium. So that's a conformational change. That's the idea between these voltage-sensitive channels. Okay, some of the channels, they have nice diagrams of inside the pore itself, that there are proteins, amino acid sequences, that are charged, and they sense the charge and they can open up a gate, okay? And then I'll allow it to move, because if you have a conformational change, it could become bigger or maybe smaller, right? So if it becomes bigger, then ion can go through. Okay. So these are the voltage-sensitive ideas. People have made many mutations on voltage-gated sodium channels, voltage-gated calcium channels, voltage-gated potassium channels. Put those into artificial membranes and see which amino acid sequence causes a big change on the voltage sensitivity. And they do this, too, to look at pathological conditions in humans. So they can relate that to somebody that has a gene mutation and the sodium channels aren't working right, and then relate that and then study how that channel's misbehaving, right? The idea is that possibly gene therapies can correct some of these channel things. So it's, people are working on it. Anybody, it was a while back, anybody remember the first gene therapy they used for where that was happening for cystic fibrosis? Pardon?
CRISPR?
Oh, it was before CRISPR. The Chinese group did the CRISPR thing illegally, but remember that one? Where they didn't get permission from the hospital or from the patients and they used the CRISPR?
Oh, yeah, and he's in jail, but he's out now. He's free again.
Yeah. That's wild. Pardon?
When they changed the genome. Babies, right?
Yeah.
They were immune to HIV.
HIV, yeah. But it wasn't life-threatening. That was the question. You're doing something that wasn't really, they could use medications for the HIV, so it wasn't like the baby's going to die from this.
It was just
an ethical issue. It was an ethical issue, but also experimentally, can we do it? But where's it was used a long time ago, actually, we can't do a lot of these things in the States because of the rules and regulations, but they did it in Italy, and they used it for cystic fibrosis. And they actually helped this person for cystic fibrosis. And what's the problem with cystic fibrosis? It's a chloride channel mutation, right? So the chloride. And then water follows in a different manner. So they can actually have fluid build up in their lungs. Epithelial cells aren't working. They get puffy on the skin. The neurons don't work right. It's a chloride channel mutation. So they were actually using gene therapy to collect that chloride channel. And that person, it was the first time they were doing it in a child, I think in Italy for that. There's lots of things that could be corrected if they get the technology down right and maybe do it early enough. The problem is you really need to start early on, right? Like almost this embryo, and then that's a lot of different problems involved. Okay, where are we going with this? Oh yeah, we were on channels. Okay, so keep me focused. Channels. So those we went through the voltage-gated ones, we went through constitutively active types of channels, and then you think about some channels, which is really weird, are called rectifying channels. They can pass current ions better one direction than the other direction. That is wild, isn't it? It's a channel. You think it's just a port. How can it conduct, say, a potassium channel better one way than the other way? That's wild. So they can rectify. That's called rectification. So that's the general idea of channels. And not all sodium channels open up with depolarization. In our heart, there's a sodium channel that actually opens with hyperpolarization. Wild. So they thought that was funny, so they actually named it a funny channel, sodium F. So it's funny. Doesn't fit the normal sodium, voltage-gated sodium channels. So it actually opens up with hyperpolarization. Why is that important in our heart? Pacemaker potentials, right? Because if you hyperpolarize, but you want to depolarize later for the next pacemaker potential, so it actually opens with hyperpolarization, sodium goes in, and starts the depolarization again. Isn't that wild? That's just wild. So I don't know if you had that in a course, but it's not always the same thing that you always think about. Mind-blowing when they figure that one out. Then there's other types of channels we haven't really talked about much. Gap junction type of channels, right? Gap junctions. These are phenomenal. We don't have many gap junctions in our nervous system. There's a little spot in our brain called the superior olive nucleus, which is a group of cells, not a nucleus of a single cell, but a nucleus of multiple cells, where they found gap junctions. That's just weird. They don't know even what that part of the brain really does yet. They're still trying to figure it out. They know that it has projections that go up into the cerebellum, but what does it do? Who knows? there's spots that we don't really know everything about our brain. And, you know, and other mammals have them too. And then where do we have a lot of gap junctions? Anybody? Where do we have a lot of gap junctions? The heart, right? Electrical flow, right? And our epithelial tissues, like in our blood vessels, in our GI tract, we have some of the smooth muscles have gap junctions in there. Our liver cells have gap junctions. So we got lots of gap junctions. And there's lots of different types of gap junctions. But when you think about it, it's wild in a sense that this cell has to make these proteins. And they're not just one big protein. They're subunits, like my fingers, subunits. So this one has to make subunits. This one has to make subunits. And the two membranes have to line up just right to make the ion channel go through, right? If they, like over here, that doesn't mean anything, right? It's on this membrane, it's on this membrane, but the two membranes have to match up just right, and they have to line up to make the channel go across, current go across. That's wild. And when you start to think about subunits, I just find that even more amazing, because then what is this? That means these are individual proteins of subunits, much like neurotransmitter receptors. Many of those have multiple subunits. They're not just one protein sitting in there. The subunits that come together, like our acetylcholine receptors in our muscles, the nicotinic receptors are different subunits that come together to function. That means those subunits all have a different rate of synthesis, degradation, and they all have to line up to be just right. I mean, mind-blowing again, right? So think about those gap junctions. There's all different types. And they can allow current, you know, ions to go through. They've now realized that gap junctions, and this was not well understood for a lot of time. They thought it was only current that could go through. They now know that amino acids, depending on the type of gap junction, amino acids can go through. So that means nutrients from one cell can go to the other cell. That's really quite cool. But guess what? They're also pH sensitive. They can close, depending on the pH. And they found out that the pH sensitivity comes because if it's too acidic, calcium doesn't bind to the proteins inside. And so it's actually calcium dependent. So calcium has to be around, and then it allows it to work. But if the pH drops, becomes more acidic, calcium can't bind to the protein, and it closes. So it's kind of like calcium, pH regulates the calcium binding to the protein that allows it to stay open. If the pH drops, calcium can't bind, and then it closes. Wow. So what happens to our heart? Why do we have arrhythmias in a low pH? Maybe somebody wants to present that one. And think about, when you start to look that up, you're going to find out we don't really know. It's phenomenal. Which channel is it that's affected? Is it the gap junctions? Is it the pacemaker cells? Is it the funny channel? Was it one of those potassium channels? Is it the calcium channel? Which one's most sensitive to the pH drop? And why do we have arrhythmias? Wow, if we understood that, maybe we could help, right? Understand this. But you see how complicated it is to do it. Maybe maybe the pump is somewhat pH sensitive. Maybe the sodium-calcium exchanger is somewhat pH sensitive. Maybe the calcium ATPase pump is pH sensitive. Or maybe they're all a little bit sensitive, but when you aggregate it together, you get synergistic effects, right? Not just additive, but synergistic, more than additive effects. This is where people are studying things. We have a person over in biomedical engineering here at UK. He actually works with heart cells. He's looking at calcium imaging, so an indicator that's inside the heart cell, and then he can stimulate it. He does rabbit cells. Heart cells, at least he used to. I don't know if he's on rats now or not. And then he can actually see the calcium domains that, you know, light up when calcium comes in. It gives off a fluorescent signal that he can actually detect. Well, he's putting that in and understanding how the other channels work and then building computational models, because he's in biomedical engineering, so he can have a computational model of the different types of ion channels that work during a normal pacing. But then if we tweak one, how does that mess up the whole pacing, right? And so this is why computational models are, you know, really important, because you can play with it on a computer and then experimentally go in and maybe knock that one down or make a mutation and see if how that does it match. Are you describing it well? And this is where pharmaceutical industries are quite interested too, in computational understanding biophysics. In these complicated situations, like a heart pacing cell is really complicated. But we don't have enough information for everything yet, like we were just saying. Which channels are pH sensitive? How does the temperature affect that? You know, some people that raise their temperature when they exercise, they have an arrhythmia, their heart stops working, and they didn't really figure it out until they were until high school and athletics. You know, they're on the football team or the basketball team, and all of a sudden they have an issue because of some other issues that are going on, right? So it's really amazing, so many things. No, I don't want to, too long on this. What was the other thing we were on? Gap junctions. Oh, yes, gap junctions. Really cool. Where did they first describe gap junctions and how gap junctions go, how big molecules can go across a gap junction so they understand the size of the gap junction? Guess where they figured that one out? One of your wonderful preparations again, the lobster preparation. And not just in muscle cells in a lobster, but they actually worked it out. When you touch a crayfish or a lobster on the tail, let's say this is the tail, boom, they tail flip, right? They tail flip away from that stimulus, the little tail flip this way. There's actually sensory neurons in the tail, sensory neurons that go to an interneuron. That interneuron goes to a motor neuron, and that motor neuron goes to muscles. So when you touch them on the tail, and they tail flip, that's a real fast escape response. That's why in a lot of animals have these fast movements in their nervous system. If you study it, and they're really fast, you'll probably find gap junctions in there. So they looked at this, and a guy at Stanford, in UCLA, Stanford, Don Kennedy, did most of this work in the 1970s. He was runner-up for the, Department of Education, or was it Surgeon General, something like that. Anyways, a long time ago, he was really good. He worked out this whole pathway where you touch the sensory neuron, goes through a sensory neuron, chemical transmission to an interneuron, interneuron gap junctions to a motor neuron, and then to the muscle fiber. That was the first behavior ever described in an animal where they knew neuron to neuron to neuron, where they knew the whole circuit. It was so important at that time in the 1970s, he became president of Stanford University for 10 years. Because that was the first time anybody worked out the neural circuitry in a behavior of an animal to explain it. He could take he could cut the crayfish apart and have those neurons in a dish and do the same experiment and see the same thing. So this was the idea. When they were doing these experiments, they found something really unique. They found out there's gap junctions between the interneuron and the motor neuron. Well, they thought maybe the other animals have it too. So a guy at Harvard, Ed Kravitz, actually before he came to Harvard, he was working at NIH, National Institute of Health, and then he went to Harvard and he was a professor there for many, many years. I think he's still there. Probably ready to retire, I imagine. And what he did is he said, oh, well, if crayfish have those, then maybe lobsters have them, and lobsters are easier to work with. The axons are even bigger. So he found out, yes, they have the same behavior. And we can now study that. So what he did is he injected dyes into the interneuron, and he saw that they could go to the motor neuron. Wow. So then he started injecting different size dyes. And he worked out the size of gap junctions. And there's a classic paper of all these different molecular weight sizes that he looked at, and then which ones would go across the gap junction. That opened up how our gap junctions work by using a lobster preparation for that behavior that was described over at Stanford for the tail flip escape response. See how all the connections came together? Really wild. Ed Kravitz worked all that out. And then what did that do? That helped us understand our gap junctions in our heart, gap junctions in our liver, gap junctions in our epithelial tissue. Phenomenal work. Then he went off and studied aggression and submissive behaviors, and he kind of screwed up that. But anyways, he was a biochemist, and he was really good in the biochemistry. He should have stayed with that stuff. But anyways, that's pretty neat to think about how all these things come together. So the history of mixing these things together, we lose all that because it's not in a textbook, right? It's not just laid out. And that's what's kind of fun to bring all that together, I think. But you see how comparative aspects, understanding what's going on in one prep, how you could draw a conclusion to the next prep. And so they did find out that gap junctions can actually allow molecules to go through one way better on those sizes as well than they did the other way. He then changed things around, and he actually injected these same kind of molecules into the motor neuron to see if they would get into the interneuron. And it didn't work the same way. So that was kind of interesting too. And then guess where the work figured out about gap junctions being pH sensitive and calcium being responsible? Lobster preps. In the sense, because they had so much work done on the lobster prep with the gap junctions, they could then look at this activity and find out that the CO2 or pH changes blocked that gap junction from working. And then they couldn't figure out how that happened, so they started doing more experiments. That's just interesting itself. Some other aspects in the squid axon that came out about the same time, because they were very interested about pH changes now, is that they took squid axons, back to the squid, measured the pH inside the squid axon, so didn't take out the cytoplasm, keep it all the same, right? All the stuff that's inside. Repetitively stimulate, you know, repetitively stimulate as much as you could, and they actually saw the pH drop inside the squid axon. That was the first time to see that the activity of the neurons dropped the pH, which made you kind of think, oh, maybe that's part of fatigue, right? When you study too much, you're up, you know, maybe that's part of the sleep cycle. Who knows, right? Maybe it makes your neurons start to want to sleep and you get sleepy because you're too much activity. It just opened up a ton of questions, right? But you couldn't do those questions or even have those questions until you understood some of the biology that was going on. So people are still wondering about, you know, why do you get tired, right? What is it? Is it glucose? Is it something? Is it pH differences? Well, maybe it is that, you know, so who knows? So really things that are still mysteries to us that we think we understand, but we don't. It's amazing. Okay, I know I yapped a lot, but are we getting it? Is it making sense? Okay, I know it's like tangents, but it's trying to bring it all together for you. All right, so because no one really mentioned anything yet that they're quite interested in talking about, so I thought maybe what we could do is to start talking about muscle. I think I sent you 3 PowerPoints or 3 PDFs. I'll put them up on the webpage. And I sent them as PDFs because they're smaller to do. But maybe it's, since we just talked about neurons, maybe we start talking about muscle. And then we understand muscle and a comparative aspect. And then we can start to maybe talk about synaptic transmission a bit. And then a little bit of variation away from what you've learned in maybe 350 Animal Phys or another physiology course, a little bit different. So the idea here is, let's just go through some comparative aspects about muscle. And some of this you've seen before, but we had to get the basics down first to make sure everybody's on the same page. Muscle, skeletal muscle. We're talking about skeletal muscle, all right? Smooth muscle is a whole other beast. Similar to cardiac for the anatomy. So you've probably seen these kind of figures before. You know, banding patterns of skeletal muscle, we'll go through a little bit of it. But myosin in the middle here, actin, and then, you know, the actin's bound together to another protein, which we refer to as this Z disc, basically, because it has a little Z pattern in it. We'll see it up here. I don't want you to try to memorize numbers or anything. But the way they figured out skeletal muscle banding pattern is really an amazing feat. What they did, it was the guys at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute that did a lot of this work. And what they did is they took muscle from critters, they would stretch it, or they would stimulate it and make it contract, and then fix it, and then they did sections through it, and put those sections together. And some of those sections, they saw this. In other sections, they saw this. And when they had the muscle contract, most of the sections looked like this. And when they stretched it out, they found sections like this on sides, and then maybe more of these because it's pulled out. So it was really from these anatomical sections, they came up with the sliding filament hypothesis before they could actually image and see things that well. So the myosin is my pin, my fingers are the actin, my thumbs are the Z disc, and they, depending on where you cross-sectioned, they came up to realize it's a sliding filament hypothesis. So this is what they came up with. And it's pretty cool. So you could just imagine, you know, sectioning through there and then reconstructing, depending on the experiments you do, you come up with this anatomy. And that's how they came up with this anatomy initially. Then later on, they could actually shine light onto the muscle and see this banding pattern, and then they realized, oh, when they shine light and look at the reflection, they could see that some of these bands shortened and some of them elongated depending on what kind of experiment you did. So it all fit with the anatomy that they were coming up with. But the history of it is just amazing. Myosin is really an interesting molecule because you just put myosin in the, if you solubilize it with like glycerol and disassociate muscle, and then you take away the glycerol, the myosin will reform this kind of structure again. Isn't that wild? So where did we understand myosin in movements of myosin, like myosin heads move initially? You know, we didn't really understand it, but, you know, because it wasn't just muscle that they were looking at. Where we understand myosin and myosin movements first came from slime mold. Slime mold. Because slime mold moves. It kind of moves, slime mold. So we actually figured out a lot of the myosin and movement, dynamic movements of this slime mold, a unicellular cell that can move. And some slime molds can get really big. They're like a single cell, it's a gigantic thing. It's just weird. You see those horror movies, the blob, you know, that comes out of the ground? They found blobs, actually. There was one in Texas that was like 3 feet long somewhere in someone's backyard, and they didn't know what it was. So they called these, like, biologists, saw some alien landed on their property. And it was a big slime mold. Sometimes they can get just big, and so it's like a single cell. But it can actually move. And that's wild, right? So this is actually, to understand myosins, they actually first figured a lot of the activity and how myosin works is through slime molds. So here's a banding pattern. You don't have to memorize all this stuff, but the idea here is, here's this Z-disc where the actin binds to it, and that's going out, and then the myosin's right here. And so, you know, actin like that, myosin like that, and then these can come together because the little myosin heads that are on here attach to the actin, and they slide this way. So they're given these different names. If you ever have to name these things, you can always look this stuff up. We're not trying to memorize everything here, okay? And this is this idea of how these work. And then with contraction or relaxation, given these different names, H is Hille, a light in German. Z, they call this a Z disc because actually in real life, it would have a Z-like pattern right here. And this Z-like pattern is due to pulling. So when they, if you just looked at a muscle, and you saw a real strong Z-disc bending back and forth like that, really strong, compared to another muscle that was really maybe not too strong of a Z structure, what might you think about?
One is being contracted and compared to
the other one maybe contracted, and the thickness of the Z-disc itself. They've looked at different muscles. The muscles that are very force-generating, strong, tonic, all the time, have a thick Z-disc. Isn't that wild? And ones that don't do that have a thin Z-disc, just a thin band, and not a strong Z. So you kind of like, if we had an alien from another planet and we wanted to dissect it up, but we didn't understand it all, you know, just found it and we chopped up muscle, we could maybe understand more of those muscles. There's really weird questions like, what do you think? You know, I guess people are bored and they come up with weird questions. What do you think would happen to an animal that you found on the moon or where gravity's not very heavy? Would you have thin Z-disc or thick Z-disc? Probably thinner Z-disc, right? Because it doesn't need to do it. So just a thought process, you know, out there. All right, so that's the idea there about having to figure this out. And just we'll go through some of these terms and talk about muscle contraction. On the actin itself, it's really quite interesting because this actin is like two ropes, if you will, big ropes that are twisted together, okay? So the actin that comes off the Z-disc, two ropes twisted together. And between those two ropes, we have something else. It's, in us, we call this, in mammals, we call it tropomyosin. So, and it goes between the grooves of these two big ropes. So I like to explain this like having two big ropes that you twist together, that's your actin, and now you take some yarn, and you take two strings of yarn, and you twist those together, and you lay that yarn in the groove of the ropes. That visualize it, right? And so here's that yarn going through the groove of the ropes, and in that yarn is a tail, another string, if you will, that's wrapped inside the tropomyosin. And that little string has a head on it, and that's called this troponin head on there. Okay, so there's troponin T for the tail, there's troponin I up here, and troponin C, and C is for calcium binding. So troponin C has calcium that binds to it, and it causes the conformational change. All right, and there's your myosin. There's light chains and heavy chains, just different structures of the myosin. But there's ATPase activity where ATP will bind here, and ATPase activity that can cleave ATP, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Okay. So just that, and this is skeletal muscle for us. This is kind of refreshing from animal phys textbooks. If you need ATP and calcium to get tension, and if you take away the calcium, and you will get relaxation and more calcium concentration, the greater force of contraction. This is just your skeletal muscle itself, calcium. This is confusing sometimes. These are permeabilized muscle fibers. So what they do is they poke holes in the muscle fiber, put this in the bath. They can change the bath calcium, for example, so calcium can go in, or you can take the calcium away, and then you can see how it affects muscle contraction. So these are what's referred to as permeabilized muscle cells. There's a whole group in the physiology department that does this. Ken Campbell does this kind of work in heart tissues and in skeletal muscle themselves to try to understand more about tension development, for example. Okay, so you get the idea. There's troponin I, C for calcium binding, T for tail, if you will, troponin tail, because it weaves inside the tropomyosin. Okay, and now we just talked about this. So if calcium is present and ATP is added, you can have muscle contraction. We'll go through a little bit of this in a minute. And if you take away calcium, it doesn't relax right away, because if you don't have ATP around, let's say you take ATP away in this figure, if you have no ATP around, it can't relax. It could stay in a contracted state. As soon as you add ATP without calcium, it can relax. So this was kind of confusing at one point in time. So they realized that